AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 135 for February 3rd, 2012. Uh-oh, for Opel. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Hey, thanks for joining us, folks. AutoLine After Hours. I've got my buddy here.
John.
Peter.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good.
I'm doing fabulously.
Fabulously. And we've also got Chris Pruce joining us on this show, too. And I think he's with Ford or something like that these days. I'm not sure anymore.
He's in the solar system of the automobile industry.
That's where I intend to stay.
He was formerly at one time at General Motors.
Yeah, we'll get into some of that later. But you're what, Team Detroit right now, right,
Basically,
Chris?
You can call me Team Detroit. I work.
And that's part of WPP?
WPP.
Hill & Knowlton.
Hill & Knowlton is the agency, but we're all one happy team for Ford. So we basically just keep telling the Ford story in more in creative ways. And that's what I'm all about.
Cool. Well, we'll get into some of all this stuff. But, Peter, you've got a contest you want to run.
Yes, I do. This beautiful black Swatch sports watch with Degla lime green pointers and stuff is going to be available to the first AutoLine After Hours viewer who can answer the following. I'm making it a two-part question.
A two-parter.
Okay. And Ben, we send this their responses to viewer mail, right?
Yes. So Peter's going to ask a trivia question. You got to answer it. Whoever gets the first right answer to us tonight gets this marvelous Swatch sport watch.
It's excellent,
actually. And so you got to send the email to viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv.
Okay, part one of the question. What was the name I used on Auto Extremist when I first appeared on the Internet on June 1st, 1999? Part two.
Do you have to answer in the form of a question?
Like
no.
Okay.
Because that would be too hard.
Just get the right answer.
Our viewers are a little...
I know. Challenged.
Yes. Part two of the question is, who finished fourth overall in the 1971 Daytona 24-hour? You got to have all three drivers correct and what they were driving in. That's it. Have fun.
start Googling.
Yes.
Right. Well, this will be interesting to see who comes in. Speaking of the 24 hours of Daytona, did you watch the race this last weekend?
I absolutely was there.
Oh, you were there?
Well,
in spirit.
You know, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Incognito.
Yeah.
Incognito. This was going to be the one where GM with their Corvette prototypes were going to stomp on the competition.
Oh, wait, I got to stop you right there. Why the in-the-air quotation marks
around because,
Corvette?
Well, because, GM, I think their hearts were in the right place. They wanted the Grand Am DPs to look better because they don't look that good.
They look dumpy.
Yeah. And
the new ones look good.
Yeah, so they wanted to do swoopier bodywork. And then, they decided they were going to call them Corvettes. Well, which is kind of a slap of the face of their factory Corvette racing team, but that's another column. So they did this swoopy bodywork. They actually worked closely with Grand Am to reconfigure the rules for 2012, like for 18 months worth. They tweaked these bodies and worked with Grand Am closely. So, a lot of people thought it was a fait accompli that they were going to win the race.
Just stop.
Was Obama involved in all that?
No.
Part of government motors retooling?
No, fortunately.
I mean, I have no knowledge of that from my GM days.
Fortunately not. But, that's why they run the races and that's why they play the games because, you don't win in the computer, you don't win in the boardroom, you don't win on paper, you got to run the race. And the GM effort blew up and Ford Power cars finished 1, 2, 3.
Wow.
And it was a hell of a race. I mean, at like hour 22, these guys are banging into each other. You know, still hours to go, and it was just astonishing to me that you can race that long and cars are still nose to tail.
Well, you know, many years ago, these endurance races stopped being endurance races, and now they're just basically sprint races. They go as
the cars don't break anymore, rarely break. I shouldn't say they never.
Yeah, well, yeah, GM's cars blowed up real good, and you know, but it's a sprint race. And AJ Allmendinger, who's a sterling road racer, anyway,
and a pretty good NASCAR racer these days too, oval racing.
And Penske just hired him,
right?
So he drove a tremendous.
Sounds like he's like a hamburger named after him, doesn't it? Didn't Daly's have like the Humdinger or something, like the ham sandwich that was really great down the road or something?
You know, you could be right because his nickname
is Dinger.
Right. Dinger, yeah.
But he drove a great last stint, last 2 hours.
It was awesome racing.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. So there you go, folks. That was just to buy you time to look up who came in fourth place overall
in the 1971.
Daytona
24 Hours.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have to have all three drivers and what they were in. And then what was my name when I launched Auto Extremist, the name I had on the website. And I'll explain the significance of that name if you care later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got to get that myself. So other big thing in the news this week is these rip-off Chinese designs, man. It's just unreal. You know, we ran on Daily this picture of the JAC Jinghuai Automobile Company. I think it's like the 4R3 or some nonsense, but it's a total ripoff of the F-150.
It's the E-149.
As
opposed to the F-150.
Oh, yeah.
For the more cerebral out there, got that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they basically bought an F-150, shipped it over there, and copied.
Oh, why buy it? I'm sure they just drew it off pictures. And then somebody from Australia sent us a picture. They have another truck that is an absolute ripoff of the Chevy Colorado. Just unreal. I mean,
I wouldn't doubt they didn't have to buy or do anything. They probably hacked into GM's computers or Ford's computers and download all the math data from the servers and probably just plugged it into their...
That's something I don't care to think about.
Yeah, so...
I don't even think they went to that trouble. I think they just took pictures, blew them up, did tape drawings, and started doing engineering.
You can see the court, too, when they look at this. They'll take a look of an F-150 next to this car. They'll take a look. I remember when Chery Automotive had ripped off the Chevy Spark. The GM lawyers actually took a door aperture is the toughest fit on the car. Like, the doors have to be exact. They take a door off of a Spark, put it on the Chery, screw it in, and it shuts airtight. Perfect seams. The judge looks at it and says, I don't see it. You know, it's like,
yeah, no, I mean, the Chinese courts have essentially ruled unless you have an exact copy of everything, every nut, bolt, it's not a copy. Okay. Clearly, it's not a copy unless it's a copy.
Yeah.
So you're in trouble, man, if they start copying you there. There's nothing much you can do about it.
They've actually copied the whole state of Arizona and one part of China. And that's what people haven't figured out yet. So you can actually go to Sedona in the middle of the Guangzhou province.
Cool.
Powerful.
But, yeah, I thought that was pretty wild. And then we saw January sales, and pretty good.
Yeah, there were some highline, a lot of media coverage for Chrysler and Hyundai, but I thought the most interesting thing was Toyota and Honda starting to show life.
Yeah, they didn't do all that well.
No, but they lost
market share.
Yeah, but I agree with Peter. They're starting to come back. And
right.
I think, you know, Chrysler's enjoying what Ford was living in 2009 and what GM got to live in 2010. They're just, you know, the year over comps were just so horrible that now all of a sudden it looks great and they'll get reality next year when they got to start meeting numbers like GM did in January.
But how about my pal Sergio? Chris, why don't you tell the audience what my pal Sergio was up to this week?
So, yeah, we were talking about Tom Walsh in the Free Press this morning, you know, writes the column, and at the end it was Sergio Marchionne opining on the unfairness of the government support of Ford and General Motors.
This is a guy who was gifted the Chrysler Corporation by the U.S.
They
government.
They got loans at Ford from the DOE, and our loans loan guarantees are held up in paperwork. You know, Sergio, they gave you the whole company for free. What do you want, man?
You were just there with your hand out.
How dare they not give you another $6 billion to run it with? Oh, those unfair American congressmen.
That's just wild. Man.
Amazing.
That's our Sergio. Yeah.
But still, you know, I was surprised, going back to the sales for a moment, that Honda and Toyota didn't do better. I mean, now, Toyota did get best-selling car again with the Camry. They sold pretty good numbers. But I thought they were going to do better.
Civic had a pretty good month, too. Civic
did, but Accord did not. Right. Accord was pretty weak. Yeah. But I thought this was the time where they had all the inventory and they were going to come roaring back. Maybe I'm just impatient and it will happen. But I was surprised they didn't do better.
Well, yeah, but their dealer body is so strong that, you know, once they get cranked up again.
Well, they're spending, Honda's in particular, and Toyota, they're both spending lavishly right now, advertising-wise. I mean, they really are.
And they've got the deals going.
Yeah, they got deals. You know, I think there was that graphic in the Fusion launch at the auto show where what they're spending in the mid-segment now, that average incentives are up something like, you know, almost 200% in some cases from average. So they're going to get back in there one way or the other.
Yeah, I'll bet you Honda, this is just a guess of mine, doesn't quite get back to where it was before. That's my guess. And the only reason I say that is they've had, as we've talked about on the show a number of times, a string of products over the last number of years. This isn't a flash in the pan thing. A number of years, products that just fell flat on their face. Technically, they're behind the game right now. That's not something that you fix this fall. That's going to take years to fix.
And I'll say also, and I never thought it happened in my lifetime or career, you're finally now seeing that when you look at just consideration in the marketplace, the stigma of the American nameplate, while slightly still there in some geographic areas, by and large has been neutralized heavily. Toyota's problems and the return of the auto industry and just frankly a whole set of buyers that we didn't piss off back in the 80s and 90s, you know,
who didn't know any better
are coming into the marketplace now, and I think it's a much more level playing field, which means everything's getting much more hyper-competitive and there aren't, you know, nobody's gliding anymore. I've never seen it this cutthroat. At a marketing level, at a, you know, just everybody's as sharp as they can be, and it's reflected in the numbers.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The other ones that really, I got to wonder how long they're going to be able to survive in the American market. Mitsubishi and Suzuki.
Yeah.
I mean, their numbers are...
But Mitsubishi's been, you know, hanging by a thread for, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
You know, they'll just trickle out enough cars, and it's amazing that they keep spending on this market like they do. I think they can afford it because of their strengths back in Japan.
I don't think they can. I've heard that the Japanese government gives them, like, massive... Some sort, I don't know if it's incentives, I don't know if it's write-offs,
well, it's
but some
trade.
Sort of support.
It's free trade. That's what it is.
Right.
Unaided free trade.
But here's the difference, why I think it's going to change this time, and that's where the yen is. There's Mitsubishi and
they're
Suzuki are still importing most of the vehicles they sell here.
And the yen just keeps going up and up and up. That's going to really...
So I can see two of them maybe not... going to be able to make it in this market. But it's not as if it's going to clear the decks for everybody else because last month they sold a combined 6,000 units, Mitsubishi and Suzuki, in the U.S. market.
That's amazing.
So even if they go away, it's not like everyone's going to have this feeding frenzy. You're going to have a feeding frenzy over 6,000 cars a month, which is not a very big number.
Yeah, that's for sure.
BMW fell back behind Mercedes. You know, BMW won the crown in 2011.
But, you know, luxury, premium, and I want to be the guy. I mean, is there something inherently wrong with a sales race amongst these guys? Are they going to kill their own cheese?
Yeah, GM and Ford invented it.
So, yeah, but they did. But here's the difference. These guys are doing it in the luxury segment.
That's what I mean. So
that's crazy.
What value is the brand when some schmuck down the street is making $50,000 a year can drive the same car I can because of a $399 lease deal? I mean, is that, you know, no offense to $50,000 a year people. I'm just saying.
It's not a good thing. And BMW were blowing out cars like big time in December, so they just decided.
Oh, I think Mercedes blew out a whole lot more than BMW did.
Yeah, but Mercedes did too, but you can tell that the BMW home office said, okay, we're taking a break in January. And so They should just stop doing whatever they're doing. Notice Audi doesn't say anything.
Doesn't need to.
It doesn't need to
get into this kind of war. It just needs to keep its nose down.
And they're making...
Push the premiumness of the brand.
I bet you they're making more money per vehicle than BMW.
Oh, well, I would hope so. I mean, they're much more integrated and using much more shared architecture and shared componentry with the mother brand of VW, so they should be.
Yeah, and speaking of VW, man, they had a phenomenal month.
Yeah, they're adding
phenomenal.
They're adding production to the Passat, too.
It's selling very well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we in the media criticized it. Oh, it's not German enough. It's not Volkswagen enough. Well, we forgot to talk to the people who buy cars because they love this thing.
Yeah. Well, I still don't really like it all that much. I think if you order it right, it's what a Volkswagen should be. Mm-hmm. But the standard car, I don't know. It's so.
I'll bet you they don't sell many of the standard cars.
Yeah, I hope not. Boy, those.
Well, their transaction price isn't too far off where it was before. Now, one of the reasons is, even though they had a high sticker price before, they discounted like crazy.
Yeah, they don't have a great story on incentives, I think, by and large, over the last several years. And
meaning that they had too many of them.
Too many of them. I mean, it's pretty easy to get your hands on one. So, but that's what the price, it's all about carrying price now, too. I mean, I think the days of buying your market share for the most part is gone.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed is everybody criticized the Volt because sales were down. and they were down a lot month over month. But so is the Nissan Leaf. In fact, while everybody's, you know, jumping on the Volt for not selling all that well, Nissan sold 76, maybe I think it was 73 more Leafs than Chevy sold Volts.
In my hiatus from my exit from the former company, I was doing a lot of consulting work, and I did some stuff for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. They wanted to delve into this issue about advanced technology cars getting geared up for a possible CAFE debate, so I ran a lot of numbers. If you look at the aggregate rate of sale for advanced technology cars, and Ward's has been tracking this since about 05. It started out with about two or three nameplates, and really it was just the Prius and a few other knockoffs. If you look at the total volume, not the rate or the share, the terminal volume has moved from like what started out at about maybe a 10 to 14,000 a month clip and swelled in the best of days to maybe 30, 32,000 a month clip. The number of nameplates went from like 4 to 14. But if you look at it, if the market goes up, it stays stable. If the market goes down, it only goes down a little bit. If gas prices spike, they go up a little bit. If gas price goes down, they go down. What it tells you is nobody's buying these cars for their economic relevance. They're buying them for the same reason they buy a Corvette or they buy a Porsche. It's a lifestyle statement. There's only a handful of people who want to pay that money to get that lifestyle statement. And the market is hyper-rational. It's a fact.
Right. So
it has nothing to do with the Volt, the marketing, the government. It's just there's only so many people that are signing up for a car that's packed full of batteries for $40,000. That's
right.
The way it is.
Well, look, I did an interview last week with Margot Oge, who's like one of the top people at the EPA. In fact, she's in charge of anything to do with transportation. She's in charge of it at the EPA. She told me in 2025... 90% of all the cars and trucks on the road are going to be gasoline or diesel engines. And her forecast for electrics, 1%. 1% in 2025.
And I've had the benefit of being in one company and moving to another company and seeing all the sausage. And I'll tell you what, the exact same numbers with the exact same viewpoint and the exact same conviction. It's the same story, and I'm sure if you went into anybody else's shop, the fact of the matter is, we are still a very cost-conscious market. It's still the biggest purchase people make, and nobody rolls the dice on something that expensive.
And I would add this too, Chris. Where else in the world are they selling?
They're not.
They're not selling in Europe. They're not. In Japan, they're selling a little bit okay because the government's got big incentives on hybrids right now.
Hey, if we were all driving battery cars today, best lithium ion, and some joker came up with this magic vial of liquid and smelled really funky and said, this is called gasoline, and you will not believe the amount of BTU energy for cubic inch of space this thing does. Watch what it does, and he blows it up, and it only costs this much. We'd think it would be the greatest scientific breakthrough known to man. There's a reason battery electric vehicles didn't exist, didn't make it past the starting gate. It's just a fact. It's physics.
That's right.
You can't cheat economics. You right. can't cheat physics.
Well, you know, I talked with Roland Huang, too, from the Natural Resources Defense Council, hardcore environmentalist. I like the guy a lot. I actually like talking with him a lot. He thinks electrics are only going to be 3% of the market in 2025. Now, this is a guy who really thinks we should do electrics, so pro-electric, thinks the government should dump up. And he only sees it going to 3%.
Well, yeah, apparently nobody has contacted from the outside world the California Air Resources Board.
Yeah, they want to amp it up to 15%.
It's just insane.
When did they have their first EV mandate? Wasn't it like 1991?
They just came out with 2025. They just came out.
Oh, I know, no. But I'm saying if you go back, I think it's back to 1991.
It goes back. The fight began in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. In fact, to date you, this is the 24th anniversary of my career. One of the first things I worked on at Chrysler Corporation when I joined them 18 years ago was fighting the ZEV mandate in California. So, yeah, it was like 1991. We managed to punt delays and, you know, threaten referendums. I don't think you had a substantive application. They went to LEV, then they went to ULEV instead. Then they went to SULEV. SULEVs. And then eventually you got a ZEV mandate. But CARB's philosophy is, you know, you will just keep pushing out there. If they want to go an inch, they're going to throw the gauntlet out there a mile. And, you know, and honestly, it's a good process. I mean, regulations in this country, by definition, is a process of tension. It gets crazy when all the factions start warring. But I would argue that, you know, society has been fairly well served, although, you know, there's been some bad outcomes.
Served in what way? In a due process? Because the end result hasn't really accomplished anything.
I would say it in as much that the honest truth is, I think CAFE did more to crash the price of fuel. They would have been better off without CAFE and just letting a natural flow. Eventually, gas would have become, you know, constrained based on the fact we were just sucking down too much of it. Price controls would have come in and we would have reacted to the market. Instead, CAFE put a big artificial, you know, crush on demand, and we ended up basically having gas for a buck, and everybody bought SUVs, and they're surprised that was the outcome. So that's what I mean by the regulations don't always come out right.
Yeah. Hey, why don't we take our first break right now? Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. So I see Peter looking at that Swatch Sport Watch.
We got anything, Ben?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Submissions here.
Okay, go through it again. What are the two questions?
Okay, yeah, we'll send you this watch if you get these two questions. One, what was the name I used on the website when I started on June 1st, 1999? It wasn't my name, actual. And two, who finished fourth overall at the Daytona 24-Hour in 1971? You need to name the three drivers and what they were driving.
Ba-dum-bum.
Ba-dum-bum.
Oh, yeah, say that again.
Viewer mail at autolinedetroit.tv.
So, Chris, you're working with Ford right now. I'm sure now it's, what, been over a year since you left General Motors. You must have some perspective on what the company went through.
It was an amazing journey. There's no doubt. I mean, looking back, it feels like a lifetime ago. But, yeah, it was seeing the going through the bankruptcy and going through three CEOs effectively after Rick left in a matter of 8 months, watching the transformation of the internal culture, and then the radical changes that came on, you know, late in the game with the last big turn of the leadership, which eventually spit me out the end of the Wedge-O-Matic.
So it was Ed Whitaker. After Rick was fired, it was
Fritz.
Whitaker?
Fritz, and then Ed.
Fritz. Wagner got fired, then Fritz got fired,
then Ed quit. Then Ed quit.
And now Ackerson's got it.
Yeah, and now Ackerson's got it. So, yeah, I mean, it was an unbelievable time. I'm thrilled to see, you know, the company doing so well. But again, I think, you know, selfishly, I'd still say most of the success they're enjoying is at the hands of the previous regime's product acumen and pretty thorough scrubbing from the government, you know, $90 billion off your books, a $50 billion check to go run the company and the other guys' products. you know, it's pretty
good. That helps a lot.
That helps. So
just ask Sergio.
Yeah. So
I mean, he's all the success Chrysler has in the trenches right now are for vehicles that were in the works before he got there.
Yeah. So they'll go. I mean, some hugely talented people still there. Great products, a lot of passion, great brands. And GM's doing a lot of stuff right still. I mean, they are. And, you know, personally, I, speaking from a competitive standpoint right now, being more aligned to the...
Now you want to put a boot in their face.
Yeah, well, Dan says we're at war, so, you know, it's all warfare now. But I certainly wouldn't wish the people ill. But, yeah, we want to put them out of business if we can. But in a good way.
Yeah. But in a good way.
In a good, happy way.
Yes, we want to put them down nice and quiet-like.
Yeah. Right. But it's great. Ford's great for me because I grew up a Ford kid. And Peter and I, that's the one connection we had. We both grew up the kids of well-known PR guys. My dad, not nearly of the lore of Peter's dad. But being second generation Ford, that had a lot to do with wanting to go back there against other opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really enjoying it.
So, yeah, you guys know Ford really well. I'm wondering if, you know, the easy stuff is over at the company right now. I got a sense that, boy, maybe it's going to be tougher for them. You know, they got caught completely off guard by the My Ford Touch thing. The transmission issues with the dry clutch DCT in the Fiesta, that boom, you know, they didn't see that one coming too. And don't get me wrong, I'm still very bullish on Ford. I think better days are ahead, but I think the easy part of it's over with now.
Well, I think the easy part is definitely over. You know, I think they showed well in Detroit. I think they should have not shown the Lincoln MKZ in Detroit because it was clearly the Fusion show. And now they're going to show the production version of the MKZ in New York.
Which means it'll have door handles on it.
Yeah. And
that's about the only difference.
But the one thing Ford does have is their product cadence is going to be strong.
It is strong.
But it's just, you know, yeah, it's a lot tougher because it's not the scrappy company that Alan Mulally took by the lapels and said, you know, we're doing this and we're going forward. Now people say, well, you know, Ford's there. I mean, they are very strong, competitive. Now it gets harder because they're not the scrappy company on their way up. They're very established, very competitive.
And everyone's gunning for them.
Yeah, and everyone's gunning for them. So, yeah, it gets harder. But if you look at their product cadence going out the next 24, 36 months, they've got a lot of stuff.
That was the best surprise coming in there from the outside. I mean, and again, having gotten to see the next 5-6 years from both companies and coming into Ford, you know, I would agree it's a lot harder, and I think they know that in spades. I would say the leadership culture in that company and the focus in that company is remarkable. Anybody who's been around autos knows this is a business of momentum and order.
And they have the big mo.
And, well, keeping momentum, and that pulls all the way through to the dealers, but this is not an industry that has dealt with growth. We have been in decline for 20-some years. We've managed our way down, and that is...
meaning the Detroit 3.
Yeah. And
the Detroit 3, not
right.
The whole industry.
So just like the Detroit Lions, changing a culture of losing into a culture of winning and then maintaining that culture is the trick. And I think Ford has easily made that transition. I've never met anybody like Alan Mulally. I thought I was Bob Lutz's bag man, if you will, PR guy, handler for years. I thought Bob was the gold standard of media aplomb. Until I went to an interview with Alan Mulally and was just absolutely...
He's bold. Different.
He's not just different. He's genuine. I mean, you want to think it's an act. But I got to tell you, when I got hired as an agency guy, the first call I got, I'm sitting with the last day before I leave consulting to go into the car company. I'm in a movie theater with my kids. I see my BlackBerry light up, and I see it's Dearborn. I think, oh, it must be the client. I better go answer. And I get it, and it's, hey, Chris, it's Alan Mulally welcoming you here. and again, juxtaposing to the company I left in the leadership style there, which maybe wasn't quite as engaging. And, you know, I call my Ray Day, who, you know, my client, I said, Ray, that was a great touch to have Alan do it. He's like, I didn't have Alan do that. I didn't even know he called you.
Yeah.
But,
right.
You know, of course.
Yeah.
That's
Mulally, right.
That's Mulally, but that's a difference. That permeates your leadership, changes your culture. There is tremendous focus there. But I agree with Peter. I mean, it's not peaches and cream. They know they're up against it. They're being gunned for. But I got to tell you, they're talented crew.
They're talented, and in North America, I think they're going to do just fine. The worries I have for them right now are Europe, which is everybody's worry.
Everybody's worry.
But
is
South America, too. I was really shocked to see that Ford lost money in Latin America and Asia. And that's when you go, whoa, doggy. You know, them's the emerging markets. What's going on there?
Yeah. It's going to be rocky roads. This Europe thing is everyone's sweating, and it's bad. And whether you're not positioned product-wise, I mean, it doesn't matter. This is an economic situation in Europe that's reaching crisis proportions, and you can tell some of the leaders at Ford are really concerned, and they should be, because this is bad.
Well, you know, Ford's one of the few that really did some amount of restructuring in Europe. Dagenham, the big plant in England, was closed. I know that they've reduced workforce and the like there. And I don't know for a fact, but I would hazard to guess that Ford's probably done more restructuring than anybody else in Europe. And when they can't make money there after that, yowza.
And then, you know, GM with Opel, that's a whole nother.
Oh, they haven't even gotten going yet.
Well, it's, you know, we're
trying to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about that before, and having, you know, being at Opel before I came back and after the bankruptcy to lead communications here, Opel is sitting with more than double the plants than Ford is, with essentially the same market share in production. And so when you look at that, if Ford's losing money on a restructured business with half the plants, can you imagine what Steve Gursky's facing at Opel right now?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at Mount Olympus here, and you're barefoot. I mean, it's you got a long climb, and it ain't going to be
right.
It ain't going to be easy.
And what I keep saying is, it's not even a business problem that Opel faces in terms of trying to turn it around. It's the political minefield of German politics, European, but German especially.
You just went to school. When we were fighting the fight for Opel and it became Deutschland versus the U.S. and it was the government of Merkel versus the emerging Obama government, we had Russians involved. I mean, this was high stakes. In fact, John Smith, who was running the deal for GM, is a good friend. He's going to write the book. He said it's going to be called Nopel, you know, the sale of Opel, Nopel. And but that was an amazing journey, and you're right. And we talked before, it's not just that they have this massive restructuring against all the social challenges and the legal challenges and the labor strength. You've basically got the entire balance of the industry rooting for their demise, because that will solve overcapacity to a large degree. So all of their political might, labor unions included, are all throwing rocks on the pile of Opel to try to topple it over. It's a big, big, big thing to solve.
I heard a fascinating conspiracy theory this week where you reincorporate Opel with SAIC in China.
Ah.
So it's no longer a German, it's no longer a GmbH, German company.
Yeah, that's right.
And now you get rid of the supervisory board, you get rid of all those labor guys that go along with it.
Well, they wanted to make it an AG, so they never made it to AG status, then I guess, that they stayed a GmbH.
I think it's still a GmbH. Yeah. I don't know that.
But isn't a GmbH, I think is how they say it. In either case, you're right, the supervisory board gives the labor bench pretty much 50% power on that. And now GM, interestingly, has sent a contingent of Americans over and tried to stack the supervisory board. Tim Lee's over there. Mary Barra's over there. Steve Gursky's taken over. Straka being a CEO German, but obviously, you know, an implant from the home team. It's quite an interesting drama developing on that board. But I will tell you, this is not the first, not the second, not the third, but this is literally the fourth such intervention going back to Jack Smith in the mid-'80s to try to restructure Opel. And
none of them worked.
Every American that's gone over there has gone into the meat grinder and come
pretty
back
much broken
and
their
come,
career.
Yeah, and come back as hamburger, go
right.
Talk to Lou Hughes, and you know, nobody's been able to solve it. Which is why I believe my former boss, Mr. Henderson, just wanted to sell it.
Yeah.
And was obviously reversed on that decision. By the way, the second big decision of the new board of directors, the first one to fire Fritz and then the second one to keep Opel. We'll see how those pan out for them in the long run.
We'll see. I mean, this has got to be the make or break year, though. Either you fix it this year or it's never going to get fixed. And I don't know. That's why I put some credence in this SAIC conspiracy theory. It kind of makes sense.
The Chinese could play. I mean, their insistence that their ability to export is the only way you can save Opel. But how do you, if you're SAIC, and maybe this the radical growth of the Chinese market and the indifference to brands means you could put an Opel next to a Buick in the same market where Buick's the dominant brand and expect to sell the Opel at a premium.
I don't think so. I think brands matter a lot in China.
Well, that's what I mean. I say the blind statement of the two doesn't make any sense, right?
Right. So, no, yeah. It doesn't.
So
we shall see.
Wait. We take another commercial break. We wait.
Yeah, let's do that. Hey, Ben, let's give a good shout out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Well, we're a little bit early for a roundabout.
Yeah, let's not.
Or not roundabout,
but
rapid fire. Roundabout we'll talk about later.
Let's see. Must-see TV. Okay, the Super Bowl's coming up.
And we should pitch next week's show because we'll have Gene Halliday in here talking all about the Super Bowl ads that ran.
Do the download.
Even though you wrote your column this week on all the ads that have been leaked so far.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, it's, you know, if I was running marketing of a big car company right now, what I would do is I would tell my agencies to crank up a long-form video/ads for the Super Bowl, but not actually do a buy on the Super Bowl, because what's happened this week, it's amazing to me, but the car manufacturers just can't keep it in their pants long enough. You know, they just can't help themselves.
They're showing all their ads.
Showing all their ads, and they're saying, oh, yeah, but we're buying a lot of social interaction. It's going viral. It's great. Then why watch it on the game? Because I can assure you that a lot of people, when they see a car ad, my point in my column was, if I'm in charge of marketing, I would choose not to be on the Super Bowl, because I think 99 out of 100 car ads, yes, there are exceptions, are a waste of money on the Super Bowl. So now this week, the last 2 weeks, all the car companies have been showing their ads on YouTube. I mean, they just can't help themselves.
I want to give an opposing opinion, and I don't know how foolish I am to take on the great Peter DiLorenzo in the ad space, because I am a PR guy.
But
I will try. I don't disagree with the premise. However, I would say they're no longer ads. They are marketing platforms. It's to me, it's become no different than buying a sponsorship, some sort of an engagement. You're basically buying something to peg all your communication to, and you're putting social and earned media and all these engagement activities.
I get that, but then why spend $3 million?
Because why spend $3 million on a race or $3 million
I mean,
on
I mean,
a...
You could come out with your ads in the mass of all the car companies showing their Super Bowl ads, and people would say, oh, wow, this is great.
Hey, if the NFL would let you get away...
Here's the difference is that
you don't have to say, who can stop you from saying I got a Super Bowl ad
next Monday? If there's a car ad that's really good that hasn't been pre-leaked, that's what everyone's going to be talking about.
But Peter, look, I was on today on YouTube. We were on YouTube today, and the Jerry Seinfeld Acura ad is up to 7 million views. That's a lot of eyeballs. And, I mean, it's all over the place. I've got auto in my Facebook profile. I had everybody's ads pumped into my Facebook page on the paid side of the right on the right column.
It's cool, but what I'm saying is you could circumvent all of this, and you could have just as big of a splash.
I don't disagree, but couldn't you tell me this? Can you say can you use Super Bowl?
You don't
the
have
term
to.
Super Bowl, are you infringing on NFL property
no, you don't have,
aren't paying
no,
for?
Yeah,
it?
No, you, I wouldn't say Super Bowl.
You just do it in the vortex.
Yeah,
the
I would
mess.
Do it in the
here's
vortex.
Here's our new ad. Look.
Here's our new ads. And everyone's like, wow,
did you see
that Belch Fire 8 commercial?
No, every car company ad guy just said, that's brilliant. Jim Farley's probably pounding to say, why did you do that, Peter?
No, I get the whole platform. It's always about the platform. But, you know, I would circumvent it. I wouldn't call them Super Bowl ads. But, okay, here's an example. Audi's going to have this spot called Vampires on the game, which truly sucks. A couple weeks ago, they released...
I by the way, agree.
I mean, a couple weeks ago, they released a commercial early on, you know, YouTube about called Ahab. Oh. And it was this guy who's a tow truck driver in some, you know, like it had Fargo music in it, but he sounded kind of like Robert Shaw in Jaws when he's talking to, you don't know what these things are. And he's, and this guy's talking to the audience. He said, yeah, you know, and he's, the only thing missing was he wasn't smoking, you know, and he's talking about the one that always gets away. Well, what always gets away is a Quattro. It's brilliant, and it's the 60 is brilliant. And then they show up on the game with this vampire thing, and it's just like, oh, my God, what are you guys doing? So here's that Ahab spot that I'm sure generated a lot of great vibe and goodwill towards Audi, and then this vampire spot's going to show up in the game, and it's so stupid and silly and beneath Audi. I just don't get it.
Well, you know, remember when we had Jim Hall in here after the Detroit Auto Show and what we were talking all about, what we liked and everything. And one of our conclusions was, wouldn't it be really cool to go to an auto show where you didn't know what anybody was going to show?
Yeah, you know what?
God, it would be great.
All right, so let me just, let's take that one on. So we have that same call every year within the PR ranks. Oh, we have no surprises left. You guys leak everything. It's all out there. There's no surprise. And then you look at the metrics. And everything's about the throughput and the metrics. And I've looked at this every year, and it's the same debate that's gone on at Chrysler when I was there, at the GM when I was there, and at Ford, I've seen it here. Do you win by going long ahead and pumping out and backgrounding it to death and leaking it and teasing it and then revealing it? Or is it better to wait for the big surprise? And we ran the experiment at GM 2 years ago, 3 years, no, geez, I'm really aging, 4 years ago on the CTS coupe concept. That was going to be the big secret. And it was, I think it won best in show or most significant. I don't remember. It won award.
Best production.
Everybody drooled. And then we looked at the metrics. It absolutely got decimated by about, it finished like ninth out of the top 10 in terms of the aggregate coverage and share of voice that you got, because everybody was out there before, and all the journalists have to write 50 stories in 2 days, so they write them all beforehand when they get it all leaked to them, and they don't have time to write it when they're in the show. Now, I'm sure if we kind of kept tracking it going forward, we probably recover.
Well, that's
that.
What I would maintain, too. Plus, I would say that GM doesn't do a very good job of unveiling
cars. Oh, they're
cars
terrible. They're terrible. Everything
show.
At GM's terrible.
Especially, I'm the one saying it. I'm not getting you to say
that,
it.
That Chevy reveal at the Detroit was just
and conversely, I thought Ford did that Fusion reveal was the best of the show, and it was really impressive. But hey, let's get to rapid fire. Let's see what the viewers want to hear. Ben, let's launch it. Okay, Dr. Botox wants to know, is it possible to shut German auto plants?
Yes, if you basically it can be done. It has to be done with agreement of the labor bench, but it essentially equates to massive compensation for individuals, and you still carry the full pension liability under law. So it goes something. I think it's like $200,000 to $300,000 a head, and you still carry the pension liability for them under the law. So.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big ticket. It's very difficult.
Ray Schaffer says, what insider information do you have on the next Viper? We're looking forward to seeing this in the very competitive sports car marketplace. There is going to be some Maserati spillover between the two, allegedly.
Between the Maserati coupe.
And the Viper, but I would guess from a tooling standpoint, the bones of the car are pretty much going to be the same, is what I would imagine. Hmm. You know, some styling difference. I know Ralph Gill has hinted at, you know, things, and he says it's going to knock our socks off.
And it's not going to be a V10, it's going to be a V8.
Is that right? Okay.
Well, we'll see, but if I were doing the car, it would be a V8. I don't care what the purists say, because they've got the V8 to put in it.
They do. They do.
There's
and
no point doing a V10 if, under Sergio's view of how the world works.
And New York Auto Show, Somehow I think that we're going to see it at the New York Auto Show.
They're going to surprise concept unveil there?
They leaked a silhouette teaser photo, yeah. Which means that they're getting very close to showing the car. So I'm guessing New York Auto Show. Let's see. DC Auto Geek says, the recent draft highway bill requires the DOT to submit a report to Congress on vehicle-to-vehicle communication.
Ooh, I know this space.
Could this be the beginning of to the grid, and how fearful is Peter?
Not be dead by then. No, I don't know. You know, yeah, they are going to have these vehicles that weren't you involved in
it? I was the former president of OnStar, so yes, we had the V2V programs.
I'm wowed by V2V. I think it's an awesome technology.
So how long, what, 3-4 years?
I think V2V will evolve. The difficulty of V2V being implemented isn't that you couldn't come up with some cursory level awareness between the cars. I mean, if you need transponders or GPS and some sort of a way to convey information, for us it would probably be cellular. The difficulty in it all is that it takes about 15 plus years to turn over the fleet. In aggregate, in this country, it's longer now. It's like 20 years now to turn the fleet, and then even then, you have other cars. To be effective and to get the management, you would need everybody to be equipped. So you could force transponders onto older cars.
That's the ideal world. I've seen studies that show once you even start to get to 10%, you can start seeing the difference happen.
You can, and I think in terms of timing lights, monitoring traffic flows, because you have probes in the
full boat. What I'm talking about is GPS and Wi-Fi. So a car knows where it is, yeah. GPS, and Wi-Fi, it tells everybody else where it is.
Right.
And
but again, it is
so that they can't crash into each other.
Yeah, but if you only have 10% or and here's the other issue with that, is that then you get into big behavior modifications. So how many of us who drive daily with rear backup detection on their car and then they go to the airport and get their rental car that doesn't have it, and the brain's waiting for the beeps as you're just kind of whipping backwards, looking at the BlackBerry or whatever, and all of a sudden, you've hit the car behind you because you were trained to
whip. Well, I never rent a car, so I never run
into
it.
Most people don't. You get that behavior modification and then you don't have it as an issue. I think it's going to come. I think we're talking Jetsons era stuff, and I think the implementation, the infrastructure, global codes and standards, how are you going to manage this against global platforms? It's huge.
Memo to DC Auto Geek. I don't think I have to worry about it very.
It's a big deal. Look, we can't even agree in this industry on basic protocols around, Bluetooth alone, everybody thinks is some common standard. The Bluetooth profiles change basically monthly. I mean, you've seen the problem with all the in-car connectivity issues we have now.
Those are minor teething problems. I don't think it's that big of an issue.
Yeah, that's right.
I think
ask people who are driving around in cars that aren't working right with their minor teething problems, as far as devices go. I think it's a big deal.
I don't think it's that far off. I think we'll start to see standards put in place within 2 years. Government standards.
They might be looking at that'll be interesting.
And you can retrofit everything into your rear-view mirror, so you could put it on cars, older cars.
2 years, let's see. It's mandated. You have to mandate it to make it work.
Okay. Jeff W. says, the Buick Regal GS is a great car, but does it really fit where GM seems to be going with the Buick brand? Besides, don't you think it will likely mainly compete for buyers with the new Cadillac ATS?
Well,
good question.
I happen to like the Regal GS Turbo, and it's cool, but it doesn't fit with where Buick's going. I mean, what are they doing?
I agree. Yeah.
To me, it would have been a great little Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
But where is Buick going? I mean, does it fit with the...
It's going wherever Opel goes.
Yeah, well, Opel's not going anywhere, so I'm concerned. As a standalone car, I like the Buick Regal. Does it fit with where Buick's going? I don't think so.
I'll tell you, the other thing on that one is that little dirty secret. If you look at average transaction prices, you look at a loaded Regal GS like that, and then you look at the lower end of the CTS line, and you find out those guys are transacting almost on top of each other. You look at an SRX, which, again, is a 5-passenger versus the Enclave, which is a 7-passenger. The Enclave's transacting higher on average than the SRX.
And here's the deal, which I've touched upon before. GM jettisoned four divisions, and they have four now. I still think they are stepping on each other. They're starting to step on each other in market because each of these brands thinks, well, yeah, we need a Regal GS Turbo, or we need a, you know, there's just, they're stepping on each other again. So maybe GM needs to turn into Chevrolet and Cadillac.
Well, I think it's even more basic than that. They're going, oh, you know, we need to attract more younger males. So we'll do a performance version of the car. Well, is the brand really about performance?
I know they were off 23% this month. With Buick down on sales.
To me, the Buick is Enclave, LaCrosse, nicely tailored, as Bill Mitchell used to say, really premium cars. I don't need, as much as I love the Regal GS Turbo, to me it was a giant.
So you don't buy the harkening back to GNX and all the Turbo 6 heritage and
all
that stuff?
Remember, the GNX is, to enthusiasts, it's the Holy Grail, but that was a slim window.
I still think the GNX was the wrong car for them to do. I think the T-Types were the wrong car.
Yeah.
And they were the best things coming out of GM at the time. Yeah. But for that brand, no, it shouldn't have gone that way.
To me, it's the Enclave. It's a beautiful LaCrosse. And where is the drop-dead Riviera?
Yes.
That's what Buick needs to be. And bring back Pontiac and call the Regal GS Turbo a Grand Am.
Okay, which car will lead the front-wheel drive near-luxury race? Acura TL, Lincoln MX, Toyota Avalon, Hyundai Azera, Lexus ES350.
Well, if you put in that segment, it'll be the MKZ all day, I think.
Yeah, well, I have to hardly agree.
You don't got no.
You guys are, okay, we'll skip that. Mitch W. wants to know, Peter, if you created and ran the perfect ad for the Super Bowl, ran it at the best moment possible, and nobody was in the kitchen at the time, what would it be worth the next day to your client car company?
Ooh.
Ego satisfaction and back slapping, incalculable.
priceless.
priceless. But actual sales, you know, that'll play out over the next 90 days. I don't know. I don't think you could put a number on it. But, boy, the back slapping would be good.
Okay, for Chris Cruz, where do you see in car digital tech getting to in 5 to 10 years? Will today's offerings be cruft by then?
As big a lexicon as I have, cruft is not a word I've
cruft. Well, let's substitute the word for cruft.
Okay.
Will today's offerings be cruft by that?
You know, it's going to be, I believe, in-car connectivity is going to be dictated by devices being able to link to the cloud. I think the problem is the long development cycles, and the more integrated you make the technology in the car, the more you're tied to things changing underneath you. So, for instance, even on current vehicles that are coming out, there's a lot of systems now that want to just mirror your phone. So you plug in a low-cost car in Korea, you plug in your phone and you get the display just mirrors the phone and you can use the functionality. Just some simple protocols, you think. We're trying to do that. Actually, LG was trying to do that for us. And, you know, just within the course of 1 year's development time, 7 changes had to go or something like this into the system. And then you got to release the car. So I think more and more technology is going to be in the cloud. You'll have a big pipe to the car, connectivity, probably multiple pipes, big screen, memory, as much processor as you can get into the car. And you don't want to lock yourself into anything. I think the other big thing, and we talked about last time I was here, it's distracted driving. I still believe that's going to be an overriding, tempering issue to the deployment of technology. And I'll put the third one on the table, and I have deep conviction about this, and it's not just because I came from OnStar. People are overloaded with tech in the car. I mean, you basically get into some vehicles now, and you might as well be staring at the panel of a 757. And my commercial for my perfect luxury car is going to be when you can walk in with your device, touch nothing, have only the information you want present to you and programmed for you remotely by somebody else, and basically you don't have to do anything. That would be a technological breakthrough, and I think that's where this will go. You will see the technology getting simpler, not more complex.
Interesting. Fascinating. DC Auto Geeks wants to know if I'm drinking an English stout. No, an ale. Jay Cujo says, do you know if the Chevy Caprice PPV sales numbers are low because of demand, or is it due to the Aussie dollar being too strong? Well, the Caprice PPV, that's a police car.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're tied to police sales. I would say it's too early to judge how that car is going to sell in this market.
I will say Aussie dollar is a real challenge. There's no question currency is a big drag.
God, when I was in Australia, this goes back a decade ago, it was 50 cents on the dollar. And now it's what? It's par?
It's par. Yeah.
So, he also goes on to say, shouldn't they just build it in Oshawa already?
Well, the Canadian dollar's not a help either. frankly.
Right. Jadzak says, hi, Chris. Thanks a bunch for getting me those OnStar trailer hitch covers.
Oh, that's right.
I display it proudly and love having OnStar on my vehicle. Good luck with your feature, and John and Peter, keep the show going. I don't miss any of them, even if I'm out of town. All right, Al.
Thanks for remembering.
Amato says, you've talked about the average age of vehicles in the U.S. What's the average age of vehicles in Europe? You would know that.
Yeah, it was also increasing, and I want to say the average age, and I don't quote me on it, but I think we were at about 9.5 years.
That goes back a few years ago.
I'll bet you they're about
the same as us, which is 11 years now.
Yeah.
Because with the big collapse of the last couple of years, car sales have plateaued, and people are holding on to them longer.
They are, and again, cars just run better longer.
Brian Young says, Volkswagen's teaser ad, the Star Wars-themed Super Bowl commercial, the Bark Side. What in the world was that, he asks. Last year's commercial felt original. This one feels like they were out of ideas. Your thoughts?
Well, the Bark Side was a teaser.
A teaser, and describe the ad a little bit in case people...
Well, the Bark Side is a bunch of dogs and sitting in white. And they start barking, you don't know what they're barking, and then you start hearing it's the Imperial March theme from Star Wars. And it's silly and ridiculous, and then this, like, whippet walks by with... And it's cool, but the actual ad they're going to have in the Super Bowl is about a dog who wants to chase the car but can't, so he does all these weight loss things.
Has to get in shape.
Yeah, and he gets in shape, and of course it's a different dog, and he's running after the beetle at the end. It doesn't have near the impact.
You know,
of the...
I pity the Volkswagen guys and the Chrysler guys, because, you know, you score the rare Super Bowl hit as a car company. I mean, we've always been the dregs of the Super Bowl ad race for decades, and now they got to one-up themselves.
People don't understand. It's very difficult.
Well, even Chrysler is, trying to tamp down expectations, saying, look, there's no way we can match that again. And that's smart of them to do it, because they're not going to match that again. You can't.
No question.
Let's see. I think we got time for another one here. Ron Paris says, I'm going to be in the market for a new car in the next year or so, and I'm afraid I'm going to land on something that has stop-start technology, a useless and irritating feature being forced down consumers' throats because of increasing CAFE standards. Please tell me these systems are defeatable. Haven't heard or read any auto journalist comment on this to date.
I don't think they're defeatable, you're going to see them explode.
I'm not so sure, and for two reasons. Number one, Kia is delaying the intro of its stop-start on the Rio, and I test drove the car, and it's a great little car. But when the engine starts,
we heard the shutter goes through the car.
But guess what? So does the 7 Series hybrid. So does a lot of expensive hybrids.
Peter's right, though. When you got a couple years here. But when you get out post 14, the curve just steepens.
But here's what I'm hearing is that automakers are having a hard time on the EPS drive cycle, even coming up with 1 mile per gallon benefit.
Here's why. Start-stop came out of Europe. Start-stop was a CO2 reducer for traffic sitting. The federal test procedures for setting CAFE only contemplate a certain amount of idle time. And so you could be sitting for an hour saving gazillions of gallons. It will never show up in your rating on the label based on the federal test procedure and how they run the test.
Right.
So that is the problem. But that's, again, it's going back to regulations. You know, that's a very practical thing in the overall scheme of things, but it's not showing up. There's not a lot of incentive for the automakers to go there. But Peter's right. The numbers of tricks in the bag begins to narrow.
I completely agree, but I'm just saying I find it interesting that that Kia is delaying their intro. I've been complaining for the last couple of years on a number of the very high. The Prius does a great job of it. I'll tell you another car that has good stop-start is Chevy Malibu Eco. They nailed that thing. It's pretty good.
I've driven a couple Porsches, and it seems fine to me.
Yeah, they'll be on the other cars coming out of Ford here shortly. And it's. I think it's interesting. I don't think there's. It's almost like electric. So there's some skittishness about selling it, just like with the power shift transmissions. Mm-hmm. They just feel different, and people think something's up.
Yep. But and the reason that they will not be defeatable is because if you put a fuel economy device on a car, EPA wants to know it's always going
to
be used.
Well, in this case, though, it is so embedded in the electronics of how the engine operates and calibrates, it couldn't work without it.
Right. Well, look, we're at the top of the hour. We should... we got some phone calls? Let's bring it in.
Okay. Hello, John and Peter. How's everybody doing and your guests, too? My question is, in episodes past, you've talked about how Fiat really relies on Chrysler to keep going. And my question is, and I'm a huge Chrysler fan, so there might be some bias in this question, but do you think that Fiat might turn Chrysler down or make it down like Daimler did and took away from it and just leave it hanging? I hope I asked that right. In other words, what Daimler did to Chrysler, do you think Fiat will? Thank you very much. Enjoy your show very much, and enjoy listening. Thank you. Bye-bye. And this is Scott, and I'm from the Villages, Florida.
All right, from Florida.
I think Fiat's beholden to Chrysler's success now.
It's their only profitable point right now, I think. You know. Yeah.
Yeah, if anything, the opposite's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, there's even rumors, I don't quite believe them, that Sergio Marchionne may even move the headquarters of the company to Detroit.
I got to tell you, and I know Peter's got strong opinions about Marchionne, but having lived through this whole horror story for the last 3 years, I still think he's going to look like the smartest guy in the room when all's said and done, because he's going to have scored the most for the least. And I am super impressed with the Chrysler lineup. Every time I see the redo of the 300, get into a Jeep Grand Cherokee, and see that new Dodge Dart, which I think is a great-looking car, I think they're going to do extremely well.
And I'm with you, Chris. I'm pretty bullish on where they're going. I like the management at Chrysler. And what I like, too, is in the past, Chrysler always did a good job of styling. But the cars weren't quite up to the design. Tom Gale did a brilliant job, but the rest of it wasn't there.
We did on Jeep back in the day.
And I'm telling you now, I'm super impressed by the way the 300 drives, the way the Grand Cherokee drives. I mean, up and down the line, these are real cars, and I'm very bullish on where Chrysler's going. And the good stuff isn't even in the showrooms
yet.
This
is the stuff that was the Band-Aid stuff.
Right.
So.
Oh, we got a few more questions that just came in quick. Sean wants to know, any word on the Ford Falcon? I'm sure he's talking about Australia. Will it stay rear drive or go front drive or all-wheel drive?
I have no
knowledge.
Okay. My bet is it stays rear drive.
That's a big controversy, though.
I know it's a big controversy.
Yeah, big.
But I still think it's absolutely possible to meet CAFE standards with rear drive in the mix. I'm not saying most the mix.
Oh, you're right.
I'm saying you can have rear drive.
Well, you're going to do it with trucks. It's all based on footprint. So, yeah.
Right. And Unsprung asks, has anyone seen any numbers on if Super Bowl ads bring in more sales? You guys ought to know that one.
They can be positive. Yeah, absolutely. It can put a company on the map. My best example of that, GoDaddy.com was nowhere. I mean nowhere when that guy took a flyer in the Super Bowl. And now, he said in interviews, it's because of the Super Bowl ads, his company is now, I don't know if it's the largest, but it's...
That's a .com, you know, in a mega growth business. What about in cars?
In cars, you know, I don't know. Did the Chrysler M&M ad do anything immediately for Chrysler sales? No. It made people around here feel good for 5 minutes. And, you know, it kind of got Chrysler in the discussion. But was there people clamoring to knock down the showroom doors and buy cars after that ad?
What's the great advertising question? I know half of all advertising is effective. I just don't know which.
Yeah, but I would take issue on the Chrysler 200. Sales were up 850% this month compared to a year ago.
Well, yeah, but...
And a year ago was about the time when the ad...
You keep talking about that... little 200, but that's okay because it was a bad car before. Now they've glossed up the pig, and you're never going to go broke in this country overestimating the taste of the American public. So if they like that, if that floats their boat, more power to them. But I'm not going to assign greatness to that car.
No, I'm not either. I'm just saying.
And I don't attribute it to the ad either. I think it's just they put money on the hood. That's all they had to sell, and
fleets.
They could grind them out. They had fleets, and it's all good, and that's fine. Again, I will say, I think Chrysler's done a great job, but when I say that, it's the true believers who were at Chrysler in the trenches, who did the great Grand Cherokee, who did the reskin of the 300, who did whatever they did. That's why they're successful right now. Sergio had his hand out. They gifted him the company without all the debt, without all the problems, and he just, the financial problems, and he's just, you know, he's smart enough to not screw it up. So if he's the executive of the year, that's fine.
Well,
not to me.
We said before, I think they're only just getting going.
Yeah.
But, why don't we wrap it up at this point? This has been great having you here again, Chris. I mean, it's really cool having you down here, or
anytime.
Up here, or over here, or whichever way it is.
I'm a Northville guy, so I'm nearby.
Oh, yeah, very nearby. And Peter, good seeing you, as always.
Good seeing you, John.
And next week, we'll really get into those Super Bowl ads.
Yeah.
And parse all that. But, we want to thank the volunteers in the chat room who helped us. Want to thank our sponsors for making the show possible. Remember, you can friend us at facebook.com/Autoline Detroit. Follow us at twitter.com/Autoline. Go to autoextremist.com. Follow Peter at twitter.com/Autoextremist. And I mentioned that we would talk about Roundabout later in the show, and this is that time. The guys are going to have Bob Hall, yes, the evil twin brother of Jim Hall, on tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., but thank all of you for having joined us.
And good night, Simon, wherever you are.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at Autoline.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
We don't have a winner, huh?
Oh, I guess we don't.
No.
We can do it again next week.
Yeah.
New question.
No, same question.
Well, if they can't get it after a week, I think you gotta pack it in.
Two-part question. First question, what was the name I used when we launched Auto Extremist on June 1st, 1999?
The pen name or pseudonym?
Pen name, whatever. It was only on the site for
Nom de guerre.
For 3 months. Second question, who finished fourth overall at the Daytona 24-Hour in 1971? There were three drivers, and what were they driving?
So you got to send the email to viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv. Detroit.tv. 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 Detroit.